On this March the 3rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. In a last-minute deal to secure all 50 Democratic votes in the U.S. Senate, lawmakers and the president settling a debate over that $1.9 trillion coronavirus pandemic relief bill, phasing out some of those who would receive the stimulus check of $1,400. And to the president saying it is wrong for the governors of Texas and Mississippi to eliminate those mask mandates and to reopen those states at 100% capacity. Meanwhile, the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, delivering his first major speech today outlining foreign policy objectives. We'll get some reaction from former National Security Advisor John Bolton about the speech and the threats facing the United States. And in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo saying he is sorry, but he will not resign as he continues to deal with allegations of sexual harassment. Some of the stories shaping Washington Today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with the U.S. Capitol Police indicating today that they have obtained intelligence that shows a possible plot to breach the Capitol by an unidentified militia group tomorrow, Thursday, March the 4th. That is the date that some people believe former President Trump would return to power. Now, the intelligence comes in a new FBI bulletin indicating that the group could include the Three Percenters. We should point out the Capitol complex remains surrounded by temporary fencing, topped with razor wire. An estimated 5,000 National Guard troops continue on the site and across Capitol Hill. Because of this new threat, the House late today announcing that they will be wrapping up votes this evening before recessing for the rest of the week. That is a change in the House schedule. In testimony before the House Appropriations Committee, this assessment from the acting chief of the U.S. Capitol Police Force.
I want to ensure everyone on this call that USCP is working with all of our law enforcement partners in the D.C. Capital Region to make sure that all of the intelligence we have and threats to the campus, we are prepared to respond appropriately. We do have some concerning intelligence. That intelligence is law enforcement sensitive, and it wouldn't be prudent of me to share it in a public hearing, a public format, but I would love to come over. I'm available at any time to provide an additional brief to everyone on the call. But we have enhanced our security posture. We've taken immediate steps to let the National Guard as well as our workforce know what to expect tomorrow and going forward. Other than that, I'd be more than happy to come over and provide you a brief.
And those remarks earlier today by Yogananda Pittman. She is the acting chief of the U.S. Capitol Police Force. The FBI describing the Three Percenters and other fringe groups with the goal of having 50,000 members from around the country travel to Washington, D.C. on or around March 4th, which is tomorrow through the weekend, to participate in a plan to overrun law enforcement and the National Guard troops at or near the Capitol complex. A story we will, of course, be following in the days ahead. Meanwhile, in a Senate hearing, the commanding general for the National Guard explaining why it took more than 3 hours for former President Trump's Defense Department to approve a request for the D.C. National Guard to intervene back on January 6th. Major General William Walker testifying that he had the National Guard troops, that they were ready, that they were sitting idly by for hours before he was finally given the authorization to send them into the field. He told two Senate committees that the delay was caused, at least in part, over concerns of the optics of sending uniformed troops to the scene on Capitol Hill. We have posted the full hearing on C-SPAN's homepage. Here is part of the Major General's testimony.
The District of Columbia National Guard provides support to the Metropolitan Police Department, the United States Park Police, the United States Secret Service, and other federal and district law enforcement agencies in response to planned rallies, marches, protests, and other large-scale First Amendment activity on a routine basis. A standard component of such support is the stand-up of an off-site quick reaction force, an element of guardsmen held in reserve with civil disturbance response equipment, helmets, shields, batons, etc. They are postured to quickly respond to an urgent and immediate need for assistance by civil authorities. The Secretary of the Army's January 5th letter to me withheld that authority for me to employ a quick reaction force. Additionally, the Secretary of the Army's memorandum to me required that a concept of operation be submitted to him before the employment of a quick reaction force. I found that requirement to be unusual, as was the requirement to seek approval to move guardsmen supporting the Metropolitan Police Department to move from one traffic control point to another. At 1:30 p.m. on January 6, we watched as the Metropolitan Police Department began to employ officers to support the Capitol Police. In doing so, the officers began to withdraw from the traffic control points that were jointly manned with District of Columbia Guardsmen. At 1:49 p.m., I received a frantic call from then Chief of United States Capitol Police Stephen Sun, where he informed me that the security perimeter of the United States Capitol had been breached by hostile rioters. Chief Sun, his voice cracking with emotion, indicated that there was a dire emergency at the Capitol, and he requested the immediate assistance of as many available National Guardsmen that I could muster. Immediately after that 1:49 call, I alerted the U.S. Army senior leadership of the request. The approval for Chief Sun's request would eventually come from the Acting Secretary of Defense and be relayed to me by Army senior leaders at 5:08 p.m., about 3 hours and 19 minutes later. I had already had guardsmen on buses at the Armory ready to move to the Capitol. Consequently, at 5:20 p.m., less than 20 minutes, the District of Columbia National Guard arrived at the Capitol and were being sworn in by the United States Capitol Police. We helped to establish the security perimeter at the east side of the Capitol to facilitate the resumption of the joint session of Congress.
That from Major General William Walker from today's joint Senate hearing with members of two committees, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee and the Senate Rules and Administration Committee. Now, the Assistant Acting Secretary of Defense for the Homeland and Global Security was also asked about the delay in getting the National Guard in place with this question from Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio.
In your opinion, did the attack on the Capitol constitute a last resort?
An immediate response, sir?
No. In the letter, it said only as a last resort. Do you think a last resort situation occurred when there was an attack on the Capitol?
There was certainly a last resort situation that occurred, sir.
So why did it take the Department of Defense so long to authorize the use of the National Guard, in particular, the use of the QFR?
Senator, I can relay what I've obtained from my discussions with the personnel that were involved that day. And if you'd like to go through the timeline or just answer the question based on why the decision makers, in this case Secretary McCarthy, if we go through the timeline, clearly at 2:22 has been mentioned today, Secretary McCarthy at 2:30, as I pointed out in my oral statement, went down and saw Secretary Miller at 2:30. At 3:04, Secretary Miller made the decision to mobilize the entire National Guard. That meant that he was calling in all the National Guard members that were assigned to the D.C. National Guard. At 3:04, that decision was made. Between that period of time, between 3:04 and 4:10, basically, Secretary McCarthy had asked for, he wanted to understand, because of the dynamics on the Capitol lawn with the explosives that obviously shots had been fired, he wanted to understand the employment of how the National Guard was going to be sent to the Capitol, what their missions were going to be. Were they going to be clearing buildings? Would they be doing perimeter security? How would they be equipped? He wanted to understand how they were going to be armed, because obviously shots had been fired. He was asking a lot of questions to understand exactly how they were going to be employed here at the Capitol and how many National Guard members needed to be employed on the Capitol.
Let me just say, with all due respect, and my time is coming to an end, 3 hours and 19 minutes from the first call, plea, really, with his voice cracking with emotion, as the Major General said, you have Chief of Police Sun saying, help, we need help now. 3 hours and 19 minutes. And that can't happen again. You agree with that?
Senator, I do.
Thank you.
And that's from Senator Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Robert Scalise. He is the Acting Assistant Defense Secretary for Homeland Security, testifying earlier today before the Senate, again, as the investigations continue across Capitol Hill on the events of January 6th. Now to the House, where lawmakers in that chamber spending the day debating H.R. 1, an election bill that remains a top priority for the Democrats. We should point out that H.R. 1 passed the House during the last Congress. When the Democrats won back the majority, it failed to advance in the Republican-controlled Senate, held up by Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Now that the Democrats control the White House and the Senate, House Democrats, led by Maryland Congressman John Sarbanes, ready to send it to the Senate again. We should point out, however, that is expected to hit a roadblock there. It lacks enough Republican support to overcome a potential filibuster. Democrats describe the package as anti-corruption legislation that would expand voting access and improve accountability. But Republicans argue the legislation limits political speech and represents what they call a federal power grab over the states. Here's Republican Congressman Rodney Davis of Illinois.
If signed into law, H.R. 1 would be the greatest expansion of the federal government's role in our elections than we've ever seen. By moving these decisions to D.C., we are further removing people from the laws that govern their elections. People should have more say in how their elections are run, not less. Our goal is to always ensure all eligible voters are able to vote and all lawful votes are counted. It's not what H.R. 1 does. And the only witness who has run an election before said during the single House administration hearing held on this bill that H.R. 1 will undermine many of the election laws states have put in place to make it easier for people to vote and improve their election process for their voters. One-size-fits-all mandates from Washington will not fix the problems we've seen in elections across the country. They will just cause more chaos and confusion. These issues need to be solved at the local and state level. Instead of dictating to states, we should be working with them and localities to address these issues. And I stand ready and willing to work with my Democrat colleagues to do just that. But I will not vote for a federal takeover of elections. I will not vote to use the federal government to put more money into my campaign. It's bad policy. It's bad for the American people. I urge support for the motion to recommit at the appropriate time, a no vote on the underlying bill, and I reserve the balance of my time.
That from the House floor debate on H.R. 1, responding to Congressman Davis of Illinois is California Democrat Zoe Lofgren.
I'd like to just give some perspective here because all over the United States, because of the pandemic, efforts were made to allow for people to vote and not have to endanger their health. And so absentee voting became more of the norm. There were more early voting efforts, a lot of things of that nature because of the pandemic. And what happened? There was a huge increase in turnout, both among Republicans and among Democrats. It was a safe and secure election, the most safe and secure election in modern history. There wasn't a bunch of fraud. You know, some of my colleagues said, people don't trust our system. Why is that? Because there are politicians in this country that are misleading the American public about that election. And I would say the former president is first among them, telling things that are not true and convincing people of that. So now that we've had this huge turnout because of the pandemic, we're seeing states, Republicans, I must say, unfortunately, all over the United States trying to cut off access to the ballot. In Georgia, they just passed a whole slew of voter restriction measures to try and tamp down turnout. And we see hundreds of bills being introduced to do that. So I would urge a yes vote on this en banc and on the underlying bill.
That from Representative Lofgren, one of the leading Democrats pushing for congressional passage of H.R. 1. So what exactly does the bill do? Earlier today, I asked Amy Sherman of PolitiFact to outline some of the key elements in the legislation.
Well, the first thing to know about the bill is it's nearly 800 pages long, so there's a whole lot of stuff in the bill. The overall goal of the bill, written by Democrats, is to make it easier for Americans to vote, both by mail and in person. So it addresses every aspect of voting, everything from mandating no excuse absentee voting to rules about voter registration. other section of the bill creates new campaign finance rules that seek to reduce the power of big money and dark money in politics. And many of the ideas in H.R. 1 are not brand new, including same-day voter registration, which some states have adopted on their own.
Let's take some of the issues that we've been hearing from congressional Republicans. One is that this will take away the rights of the states. Can you address that claim?
Yeah, that is probably one of the top reasons why some Republicans have opposed the bill. Currently, states make a lot of their own rules about voting, including who can get an absentee ballot, whether they need an excuse such as being out of town or ill. And some politicians say that the state elected officials who know their communities best and live there should continue to have the power to set all those rules rather than lawmakers in D.C. Now, here's the counter argument to that by Democrats and those who support H.R. 1. They would say that the goal of the bill is to make it just as easy to vote in a blue state as a red state or a battleground state. Now, keep in mind, at the same time that Congress is debating H.R. 1, there are state legislators across the country who are debating laws, many of which would make it harder to vote, including getting a ballot by mail. And H.R. 1 is essentially kind of sending states the message, hey, we aren't going to let you make up your own rules that could have the impact of making it harder to vote for some of your constituents.
We're talking with Amy Sherman of PolitiFact. Speaking of states, does this bill provide some framework for Washington, D.C. to become the 51st state?
Well, the bill includes a finding in favor of statehood for the District of Columbia. It states that the 700,000 or so D.C. residents deserve voting representation in Congress, much like the other states, that there are no constitutional or other reasons why they should not be granted statehood.
And finally, the issue of ballot harvesting. When you hear that term, what does it mean, and how is that addressed in H.R. 1?
Yeah, ballot harvesting is a tricky term because it's not an official legal term, and some voting rights advocates consider it a negative or pejorative term. But generally, it refers to if someone picks up your completed absentee ballot for you and then submits it, either dropping it in a mailbox or driving it to an elections office or putting it in an official ballot drop box. So H.R. 1 says that states shall permit a voter to designate any person to return their completed absentee ballot. There's a key caveat. The person can't get paid based on the number of ballots returned. So H.R. 1 would allow so-called ballot harvesting, but with some rules. And it's important to note that each state sets their own rules right now on ballot harvesting, and some, with certain rules, do allow it.
More details on the PolitiFact website. Amy Sherman, we thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to Washington Today, C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. Here are some of your other headlines. Despite the pandemic and instability in the region, the Vatican saying Pope Francis is moving ahead with this week's papal visit to Iraq. The trip begins on Friday through early next week. And here in this country, states are expanding those who are eligible for vaccines. Arizona, Connecticut, and Indiana now allowing younger people to get the vaccine. Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are reserving the first doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for teachers. And Detroit factory workers can also get vaccinated starting this week. In Albany, an apology today from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo while announcing he will not step down. The Democratic governor saying he was sorry for any pain he may have caused three women who claimed that they were sexually harassed. Some of the reporting this past week on the New York Times website and in the newspaper. The governor also asked the public to reserve judgment until the state's attorney general completes a separate investigation. Here's Governor Cuomo.
Some politicians will always play politics, right? That's the nature of the beast. I don't think today is a day for politics. I wasn't elected by politicians. I was elected by the people of the state of New York. I'm not going to resign. I work for the people of the state of New York. They elected me, and I'm going to serve the people of the state of New York. And by the way, we have a full plate. We have COVID. We have recovery. We have rebuilding. We have a teetering New York City. We have a terrible financial picture. We have to do vaccines. So, no. I'm going to do the job the people of the state elected me to do.
That from Governor Cuomo earlier today, a lawyer for Charlotte Bennett, one of the governor's accusers, saying that the news conference was full of falsehoods and inaccurate information. And another accuser, former Cuomo advisor Lindsay Boylan, saying, quote, on Twitter, how can New Yorkers trust you, Governor Cuomo, to lead our state if you don't know when you have been inappropriate with your own staff? Meanwhile, the Department of Defense Inspector General issuing a critical report on Congressman Ronny Jackson during his time serving as a top White House physician, concluding that he had, quote, made sexual and denigrating comments about female subordinates, violating the policy for drinking alcohol while on a presidential trip, and taking prescription-strength sleeping medication that prompted concerns from his colleagues about his own ability to provide proper care. The findings outlined in the report stem from an IG investigation into Ronny Jackson. He currently represents Texas, serving in the House of Representatives and sitting on the House Armed Services Subcommittee, which oversees military personnel. Congressman Jackson claims that the report was politically motivated. Meanwhile, the president is critical of the governors of Texas and Mississippi for lifting coronavirus restrictions, calling the moves Neanderthal thinking. The two governors announcing yesterday that their respective states will be reopening at full capacity without any requirements for masks or face coverings, bringing this response at the White House.
How do you do the question?
Message to Texas.
All right, thanks, guys.
Texas, I think it's a big mistake. Look.
Thank you.
I hope everybody's realized by now, these masks make a difference. We are on the cusp of being able to fundamentally change the nature of this disease because of the way in which we're able to get vaccines in people's arms. We've been able to move that all the way up to the end of May to have enough for every American, to get every adult American to get a shot. And the last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine, take off your mask. Forget it. It still matters. I carry a card with me. I don't have it. I put it on my desk. As of yesterday, we had lost 511,874 Americans. We're going to lose thousands more. This will not occur. We'll not have everybody vaccinated until sometime in the summer. We have the vaccine to do it. Getting a shot in someone's arm and getting a second shot, you're going to take time. And it's critical. Critical that they follow the science. Wash your hands, hot water, do it frequently, wear a mask, and stay socially distanced. And I know you all know that. I wish the heck some of our elected officials knew it. So thank you very much.
That's from the Oval Office earlier today. Well, last week, House Democrats passing the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. It included a new round of stimulus checks providing up to $1,400, but now that cash stipend is going to be phased out at income levels at $100,000 under the House bill and for individuals, $200,000 for couples. Moderate Democrats, though, in the Senate had been critical of those figures, concerned that with a growing national debt, the stimulus checks needed to be phased out at a lower level. And so now those checks will be phased out for individuals at $80,000 instead of $100,000 in yearly income. And for couples, it will be $160,000 instead of $200,000. At today's White House briefing, NBC's Peter Alexander with this question to Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
You confirm that the president has signed off on these reduced income thresholds as it relates to those direct payments?
Well, let me provide a little context here, because some of the reporting, it's all coming out, so some of the reporting is aligned with accuracy and some is not. No one's fault. I talked to the president about this morning. He's pleased with the progress that is being made on the rescue plan. As someone who served for 36 years in the Senate, he is certainly familiar with the journey that it takes from a proposal to a bill being signed. And in every instance, in the final stage, which we are in now, there are suggestions, there are changes, there are negotiations between even different members, parts of one party. That's what's happening now. And he is open to, has always said, he's open to good ideas and to proposals that will strengthen the package. What he has been firm on is that the package needs to be large enough to meet the scope of the twin crises we're facing. COVID and the economic downturn. He's been firm on the importance of the $1,400 checks going out to Americans, and he has fought for that tooth and nail, and that is a bar for him. And he has also been firm on the thresholds at which Americans should receive those checks. So as we've seen in the reporting, it's $75,000 and $150,000. He has been clear that those are important thresholds to him. What we're talking about here, and I realize you didn't actually ask this, but just for clarity for everyone, is where is the ramp up and how far the ramp up goes.
Where it ends.
And he has also been open from the beginning for that being more targeted and for there to be a steeper cliff at which that ramp down ends.
From today's White House briefing with Jen Psaki, well, Senate Republicans continue to criticize the size and the scope of this Democratic bill at $1.9 trillion, arguing that it is wasteful and unnecessary. GOP leaders also point out to the stepped-up pace of vaccinations nationwide, with economists predicting that there will be a recovery in jobs and an economic growth later this year. But Democratic leader Chuck Schumer saying that the bill is necessary. This is what he had to say earlier today.
As early as tonight, the Senate will move to take up the American Rescue Plan, a bill designed to immediately deliver help to American families, workers, and businesses struggling under the weight of the pandemic, and to lay the foundation for our nation's recovery, so needed. Every day, we see signs of hope and signs of caution in our fight against the COVID pandemic. As of today, in good part because the Biden administration is really doing a good job, over 78 million doses of the COVID vaccine have been administered in the country, and over 100 million have been shipped, well ahead of the rosiest expectations at the start of the year. And just yesterday, President Biden announced that there will be enough vaccines for every adult in the United States by the end of May, far sooner than most had thought. And again, President Biden is doing a great, and his team are doing a great job in moving the vaccine out quickly but fairly. Still, the United States averages 66,000 cases of COVID per week. That exceeds anything we saw last summer during the worst months of the spread. So we cannot relax, and the need for the legislation that is before us is stronger than ever before. It's a similar story with the economy. There are green shoots, but unemployment is still over 6% and 9% for African Americans. The economy has lost 10 million jobs compared to a year ago. Tens of millions of Americans report being thousands of dollars behind in rent and utility. And as Treasury Secretary Yellen and Federal Reserve Chair Powell have repeatedly warned us, our economy and its recovery remain deeply uncertain.
And as that debate continues tonight, you can watch it live on C-SPAN 2, voicing his opposition, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn.
Our Democratic colleagues are pushing funding to support President Biden's unilateral climate executive orders. And then there's the funding, the backdoor funding for Planned Parenthood, that's responsible for the most abortions of any other organization in America. Now, that's a personal choice for people to make. But asking taxpayers to fund Planned Parenthood so it can perform more abortions is simply irrelevant to COVID-19 relief. It's exploiting another emergency for special interest purposes. This bill expands the criteria for Paycheck Protection Program, one of the most successful parts of the CARES Act that we passed last March. It was designed specifically to keep small businesses afloat. But now, Planned Parenthood can take advantage of the funding, something they were precluded from doing under bipartisan agreement previously. And there's another big political ally for our Democratic friends that would be newly eligible for these small business loans, the labor unions. So now labor unions can apply for and receive money that was otherwise previously directed toward mom and pop businesses so they could keep their doors open, so they could keep their employees on the payroll. But now it includes labor unions. Many of the labor unions' pension plans in particular have been in dire financial straits for years, long before COVID-19 even existed. Up until now, our Democratic colleagues have not been able to find a way to bail out these mismanaged pension funds. As you can imagine, using taxpayer dollars to cover the mistakes of union bosses is incredibly unpopular, and that's because it's wrong. But the authors of this bill have found a couple of workarounds which they've tucked into this pandemic, so-called pandemic relief bill.
And that from the Senate floor earlier today, Texas Republican John Cornyn. Now, one Republican to keep an eye on, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. She told the Wall Street Journal that while the bill does have too much excess, she is coming from a state where people are hurting and many need help. And on CBS this morning, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon saying that this Democratic plan will help the U.S. economy this year and into next year.
So first of all, I was grateful the president and the vice president had us in. There were four CEOs in the room. We spent almost 2 hours, and we actually covered a lot of ground from that bill to immigration to taxation to, and I love the fact you brought American competitiveness. We need to make sure America's competitive for the next 100 years, and not just to get through COVID. So I'll leave the bill itself. We need more help for those who really need it, unemployed, mothers who had to leave the workforce to go home to take care of family members or children. Small businesses who, you know, really need the help to get through this. And I'll leave the details to Democrats and Republicans to debate. But there's a lot of stimulus. It's going to get us through this. And thank God we have this vaccine. So I'm hoping when we all get to June and the flowers are coming out and people are getting their shots, that we can get back to a normal life. And the stimulus will lead, in my view, to a very, very strong economy late this year and into next year and maybe even into 2023.
That's from the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, on CBS This Morning. And on Wall Street, the S&P fell more than 1%, losing 50 points. The Dow was off 121, and big losses for the NASDAQ, down 361 points. At the CPAC conference speech in Orlando on Sunday, a speech that we carried live on the C-SPAN networks, former President Trump again indicating his desire to punish those 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach him. At a political live event this morning, the person who is heading up that GOP effort to regain control of the House said that won't be helpful. Minnesota Congressman Tom Emmer is the chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC. He is a longtime supporter of Donald Trump, but he offered this cautionary note.
Former President Trump is already out there saying he's going to primary at least the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach him. Do you think he should stay out of primaries? Should he stop?
Well, actually, what he said the other day was he'll listen to Ronna McDaniel and others. I would expect that he'd be listening to me when I told him. That's not going to be helpful. You guys get involved with the internal politics. President Trump, look at what his administration did. His administration's agenda of and all of the above, energy policy, secure borders, Americans and America First, hugely popular, brought a lot of new voters into the Republican Party. I think Republicans need to celebrate those policies going forward because, again, it gave us a lot of new voters that were brought into the party. And my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they have not only said they're going to unwind all of this, but they've already started. And they've made it very public. And I think that is going to make a difference 2 years from now.
It just to go back. So you personally asked President Trump to stay out of primaries. When was
I imagine that we'll have a conversation at some point.
And you intend to ask him?
He can do whatever he wants. That's any citizen can do whatever they want. But I would tell him that it's probably better for us that we keep these people and we make sure that we have a majority that can be sustained going forward.
That from an event sponsored by Politico, available on its website earlier today. Republican Congressman Tom Emmer, who is heading up the NRCC for the midterm elections in 2022. And in his first major foreign policy speech today, Secretary of State Tony Blinken outlining the Biden administration's priorities, promising to avoid what he called costly military interventions, while also charting a new course on global trade. He described the U.S.-China relationships as, quote, the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. And the Secretary of State repeatedly emphasized the president's desire to link foreign policy to U.S. domestic policy, including turning the corner on COVID-19 and restoring the U.S. economy. He also spoke about America's military presence abroad.
Americans are rightly wary of prolonged U.S. military interventions abroad. We've seen how they've often come at far too high a cost, both to us and to others. When we look back at the past decades of our military involvement in the world, especially in Afghanistan and the Middle East, we must remember what we've learned about the limits of force to build a durable peace, that the day after a major military intervention is always harder than we imagine, and how critical it is to pursue every possible avenue to a diplomatic solution. Of course, we will never hesitate to use force when American lives and vital interests are at stake. That's why President Biden authorized an airstrike last week against Iranian-backed militia groups targeting U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. But in that case, and in future cases when we must take military action, we will do so only when the objectives and mission are clear and achievable, consistent with our values and laws, and with the informed consent of the American people. And we'll do it together with diplomacy.
From Tony Blinken, his first major speech as the Secretary of State. And joining us on the phone with reaction is John Bolton. He served as the National Security Advisor during the Trump administration, author of the book, The Room Where It Happened, and also served as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. What did you hear in that address?
Well, I thought it was a long formulation of diplomatic pablum. I think the last 10 secretaries of state across both political parties could have said that. There's really not much in it to disagree with, since he sort of touched every conceivable base. And I don't really think it tells us much at all about what the Biden administration policy in Iraq, in Afghanistan, with respect to similar kinds of situations around the world will be.
Let me ask you about Afghanistan and your recent column in the Washington Examiner saying that we need to stay there, that this is a unique opportunity for the Biden administration. How so?
Well, I think what's critical in a decision about Afghanistan is what we think American interests are, not interests about peace processes, not interests about regional stability, not interests about multilateralism, not interest in diplomacy as such. What's the American interest? I think there are two interests that strongly argue for a continued military presence. One is the counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan against Taliban resurgence, against Al-Qaeda, ISIS, other terrorist groups taking root there. And the second is the counterproliferation mission, the concern about nuclear proliferation in Pakistan, in Iran, elsewhere in the region. These are all points that I think justify a continuing military presence there. They don't justify a number of other things like nation building in Afghanistan. But in terms of our strategic interest, that I think is what the Biden administration should consider and reject the Trump administration deal with the Taliban that comes due for a real decision on May 1 whether to withdraw remaining American forces.
And as you point out in your piece, the debate is summarized in part ending endless wars versus standing by our commitments. Where do you see the country, the U.S. in Afghanistan, its support or lack thereof?
Well, I think particularly because during the last 4 years of the Trump administration, the president himself didn't believe in our presence there. Obviously, he wasn't articulating the reasons, the interest of the United States that justified it. And I don't really think that American foreign policy should be guided by public opinion polls. I think political leaders have an obligation to explain what's at stake to the people and justify what they do. But if the leaders are not doing it, it's no wonder the people don't have any sense that there's a priority in an American presence there.
We are talking with Ambassador John Bolton. He served in the Trump administration and in the George W. Bush administration. Your reaction to the release of that intelligence report last week on Saudi Arabia, the role of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the death of Jamal Khashoggi, and the president essentially saying we are not going to penalize the Crown Prince directly.
Well, I think the Biden administration policy is confused there. I'm not sure why they felt they had to issue this report. I think prior statements explain what the U.S. position is. I think it's hard to understand what effect they thought they were going to have to release the report, but then not take any direct steps against the Crown Prince. I think the Trump administration handled that one right. Our interests lie with the Saudis in a very complex situation, especially dealing with the threat of Iran, not just its nuclear program, but its support for terrorism in Yemen and elsewhere in the region, and its conventional military activities. It's a hard, cold-blooded approach to the world, that I acknowledge, but I think that's what's required. I don't know what the Biden strategy is.
And Ambassador Bolton, you heard the Secretary of State discuss Syria, one of the issues that you had to deal with as the National Security Advisor and the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Your reaction to the airstrikes last week in neighboring Iraq?
I think retaliation was correct, given that the Iranian-supported Shia militia groups in Iraq had targeted an American facility. But I noted that the public statement accompanying the response said it's proportionate, it's trying to be de-escalatory to send that signal to Iran. And Iran's response, I think, came a day ago when they again attacked an American facility in Iraq through a Shia militia group. I think that the administration has a very difficult job ahead of it if it continues to believe it can go back into some version of the 2015 nuclear deal. I think that's a profound mistake. I think the Iran regime is hostile to us in a variety of ways in the Middle East. And I don't think they yet in the White House fully understand the real range of threats that Iran poses.
And one final question regarding North Korea. What is the threat level that we're facing from that country right now?
Well, I think they have clearly developed a nuclear weapons capability. They've demonstrated missile capabilities that can probably reach the United States. Whether they can connect all the capabilities they need, including guidance and reentry, actually to threaten us, I don't think we can say for certain that they've achieved that. But I think Kim Jong-un's regime remains a threat as long as it's in power, because I don't ever see it simply being negotiated out of its nuclear weapons quest any more than I see the regime in Iran being negotiated out of it.
Ambassador John Bolton served in the Trump administration. His latest book, The Room Where It Happened, joining us here in Washington. Ambassador, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And one final note, as we mentioned at the top of the program, because of security concerns over possible threats from demonstrators, look for some changes to the congressional schedule. With events on Capitol Hill, the House will be wrapping up business tonight. You can follow all of it on our website at cspan.org. For this Wednesday edition of Washington Today, I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.